We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Radio and online at WILL.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, we'll talk about preparing children to successfully live the rest of their lives. That's the mission of family counselor and parent Susan Stiffelman, who says kids need parents to be the captain of the ship in calm and stormy seas, not in control, but in charge. Susan Stiffelman lays out her ideas about parents and children in the book, Parenting Without Power Struggles, Raising Joyful, Resilient Kids While Staying Cool, Calm, and Connected. Listeners, join us with your thoughts and questions this afternoon. I look forward to your phone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Susan Stiffelman is a licensed psychotherapist, teacher, and parenting coach. She's the mother of Ari, who entered his freshman year this year at American University. Susan makes her home in Southern California. Parenting Without Power Struggles, Raising Joyful, Resilient Kids While Staying Cool, Calm, and Connected is published by Morgan James. And you can look for our guest, Susan Stiffelman, online at www.passionateparenting.net. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers this afternoon if you'd like to join our discussion. Susan Stiffelman, welcome. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Would you talk about the idea of being captain of the ship, not controlling, but in charge?
Sure, yeah. You know, it's interesting because we tend to think that as our children get older, it's important that we step back, and they certainly send us signals that say, you know, get out of my life, so to speak. And in addition, when our kids are younger, we struggle with wanting them to like us and feel good about our decisions and, you know, be happy versus upsetting them. But the analogy that I give is, imagine that you're on a cruise ship and you have a captain, and it's his responsibility or her responsibility to take you to safe passage. And there's a storm or you hit an iceberg. What you don't want is to see the captain, you know, start pulling his hair out and leaping overboard. You want the captain to demonstrate that regardless of what's going on with this cruise, he or she can handle it. And in the same way that no matter how old a child is, when they're upset, when they're struggling, when they're confused, when they're lonely, they really need to have us be that constant, calm, confident presence that can help them navigate through.
As you've worked with children, first as a teacher, now as a therapist, how have children expressed to you the desire that adults be captains of their ships?
It's interesting. You know, kids will, not so much in words, but in their behavior. A child who doesn't feel that they have a reliable, steady captain at the helm will demonstrate anxiety. Sometimes it will be depression because their difficult feelings or life experiences sort of get buried or go underground. They don't have someone they can untangle things with. There'll be a lot of anger and aggressive behavior. A lot of the children that I work with are chronically frustrated, and in part because the parents either all the time or inconsistently give in to their demands to, you know, avoid their aggression. But the child is not relieved by that. It actually fuels their frustration.
Yeah, there are three graphic illustrations, or three illustrations that run through the book. Yeah. And actually, on the cover, there's a tug-of-war photograph, and that's what you call the two lawyers.
Yes. So the illustrations, I'd love to be able to describe that briefly.
Yeah.
Such a cornerstone of this notion of captaining the ship. If you imagine that the right hand, if you ball it into a fist and you put it out in front of you, if the right hand represents you, the parent, and the left hand represents the child. Now, when you're the captain of the ship, the right hand is above the left hand. It's a hierarchy. You're in charge, and the child is dependent upon you, which is how it's supposed to work. When the child might say something like, can I have another piece of chocolate cake, as the captain of the ship, knowing that's probably not a good idea because you're about to have dinner, you might respond by saying, well, sweetheart, not right now. Then, if the child really likes chocolate cake, and most children do, the child will probably say, why not? And then I want you to picture that the two hands go side by side as you say, because it will spoil your dinner. So when the two hands are side by side, I do call that the two lawyers. This is where you have power struggles, negotiations, battles, and so forth. And it really tires a parent out. The final scenario would be the left hand above the right, meaning that the child now says something like, if you don't let me have the cake, I'm not going to eat any of my dinner. And you're down below there saying, well, yes, you are, young lady. If you don't eat your dinner, you're not going to get any TV for the rest of the week. So you've deteriorated. The situation has deteriorated. First, you started to engage in the discussion and power struggle, and then you fell even further down to where you're fairly desperate to get the child to do what you want.
Yeah.
And you're not captaining the ship. I tell parents one of the quickest ways to know that your right hand is below the left is that you're bribing or you're threatening. And that stems from feeling out of control, powerless, you know,
yeah,
frustrated yourself, angry, all the things that really diminish your ability to captain the ship.
So how do we steer the ship in the right direction on the chocolate cake?
Okay. So it starts by something that I call Act 1 and Act 2. Most parents parent from what I call Act 2, meaning Act 2 is about reasons. It's sort of a left brain-based part of conversation. So it's based on reason, logic, explanations, rational thought, language. So if I were to appeal to your left brain, I would say, well, honey, it's not a good idea to have the chocolate cake right now because, as you can understand, being a rational person, if your stomach is filled with cake, there won't be room for dinner. The problem is that when a child is upset, they're not in their left brain. For all practical purposes, they've left the left brain entirely, and they're over in their right brain, which is feeling-based. It's emotional. It's not language-based, and it's not logic-based. So there we are, in a sense. When I speak at schools, I'll demonstrate this, you know, the front of the in the presentation. We're sort of knocking on the left side of their brain, attempting to explain our reasons, and they're not home. And instead, we have to go and collect them with what I call Act 1 parenting. Act 1 is where it's not as verbal, it's more empathic, it's not just the old mirroring or I see that you're feeling angry, because kids really don't like that. But it's sort of acknowledging, giving them the sense that you hear and understand without hurrying them to feel better or happier. So in this cake scenario, that would be, boy, you really wanted that cake. And I tell parents, you're actually looking for the child to nod their head or say yes three times. And that gives them the sense that you're actually listening and you're not just trying to shove an agenda down their throat or override their feelings or their longing. You're acknowledging it without, you know, panicking because you're trying so hard to convince them that they can't have what they want.
And one of the ways I think I've come to see this now is if we go back to that idea of the right hand over the left, it's as if you are taking a child by the hand and walking together across the street.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a great image. And you would never in a million years just let go of the hand. And your hand, even in that scenario, it is going to be a little bit higher. You're the guide. and the child really relaxes, it provides a tremendous sense of security for a child to know that they have someone that can guide them.
Another way to think about this, and you talk about this in the book, is that you don't want to come at someone, you want to come alongside.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that, you know, that this is a very helpful image, again, when I do live presentations, but it works over the phone if you have a reasonably good imagination. Imagine that you and I were facing one another, and I asked you to put your palms against mine. And I didn't give you any instructions, but once your hands were against my hands, I just started to push against you. What would you do instinctively?
Push back.
Yeah, that's your instinct, and that's coming at a child is when we push against them. You have to do your homework now. No, you can't have the cake. Get to bed. I don't care how much more homework you have to do. We come at them kind of all the time. And when we do that, the instincts inside them are awakened to push back and resist or defy. It's just human nature. It's actually not a bad instinct at all. If you had a young child and the child was wandering off down the street and a stranger approached and said, come with me, you really want your young child to say no.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of attachment, which perhaps we can talk about, a child is supposed to resist being bossed around. It's actually a good strategy on Mother Nature's part to create the instinct outside of attachment and connection for people to resist being coerced. And so when you come at a child, you're waking up their instinct to push back and resist.
Yeah, you use that news flash at the beginning of one of the chapters. Kids don't like to be bossed around, and they're wired to say no.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there's a story in the book about a widowed father and his teenage daughter, mm-hmm. Robert and Rosie. They'd been very close, but then she drifted away. She's an adolescent. Two questions here. What had happened, and how did they reconnect?
What happened was that, like many parents, even, you know, two-parent households, as Rosie became a teenager, she was sending lots of messages to her father that he should back off and that he wasn't nearly as fun or engaging or interesting or stimulating as her friends. And because we sort of, as a society, have collectively come to accept or believe that teenagers don't want to be around their parents, they don't like us anymore, he sort of went with the program. And she drifted further away and became more and more engaged in her Facebook world. You know, these days there are so many avenues for kids to, I'm going to put this in quotation marks, connect, because it's not a real connection, but to feel that they're connecting with other kids. And that was where she sort of spent much, if not all, of her free time, either with friends in person or through the cyber relationships that she was developing. And at the same time, as she was moving into adolescence, you know, adolescence is a very difficult time, and there are kind of developmental imperatives about that period where kids will start to reevaluate who they are, what they believe in, what they stand for. There's almost always some degree of loneliness and isolation and perhaps depression. So as she was disconnected more from her father and getting more and more influence and input from other kids who were similarly affected through their own adolescence, she started to spiral downward depression-wise and did not have a strong connection with her dad to speak up and ask for help. And her behavior did not catch his eye. He just figured it was normal teen girl behavior.
And then?
And then another parent alerted him mm-hmm. to the fact that there were things posted on her Facebook of which he had no idea. And they were serious. You know, they were provocative and there were depressing things that she was saying. And it completely shattered him. He was so caught off guard and so unprepared, thinking that, you know, things were just normal. Because, again, you know, we're told that teens, you know, don't want anything to do with us as parents. And many parents just try to bite the bullet and step out of the way. But he then discovered this Facebook and was just astonished and horrified, and approached his daughter in the hopes that they could talk about it and sort things out. And soon after that, I was brought into the picture.
Yeah. What did you do? It was really, you worked a miracle there.
Well, one thing that I did is created a safe space for her to tell the truth. You know, many, many times we sent sort of subtle or subliminal messages to our kids that if what they have to tell us is very difficult or unpleasant, we'd really rather not hear, or we may just freak out so badly that they'll run the other way. We end many of the conversations with our kids before they even really start. And so in this respect, I created a safe place for her to tell the truth about what she was experiencing and going through, and had to help manage her father's reactions, because as I talked about a few minutes ago, until a child has had this act one where they get to feel heard and understood, they are not receptive to what we say to them in act two. We tend to throw these, you know, wonderful seeds on dry, scratchy soil that has not yet been cultivated or watered, and then we wonder why the seeds don't sprout. And so what I had to do, and many times I have to do this with parents, and it's interesting for me now in my work, because I actually do phone coaching with parents all over the world, all over the country by phone and Skype, and I see a pretty universal set of problems. There's not a dramatic difference from where, you know, we're all sort of going through the same sort of thing. It's very difficult for parents to manage their reactions and hold that hand, right hand above the left, when their child is saying something like, I think I'm pregnant, or I feel like I don't want to live anymore, or I hate my life, or, you know, I hate you. And so my work in the initial stages had to do with really creating a sense for her that she could tell the truth, and helping Dad, you know, manage his own sorrow and frustration. And, you know, it brought up a lot of feelings for him of grief again in terms of the loss of his wife and the fact that his daughter did not have a mother. A lot of sense of his own inadequacy, which wasn't true, but, you know, feelings of inadequacy and guilt and remorse and things like that, that until he navigated through those, he wasn't really going to be able to be there for her.
What's the right mix of attachment and independence for adolescents?
For adolescents. Okay, well, you know, there are, would you like me to go through quickly the six stages that a child moves through?
Sure.
So there are six stages, this is based on Neufeld's work, that a child will move through ideally in the first 6 years of life. And they're so fundamental to my work, and they're so fundamental to what I understand sort of predisposes a child to recognize us as captain of the ship and cooperate with us and follow our lead. The first stage, and this is the stage the child begins in infancy, is proximity. And it's the sense that the child, developing closeness, physical contact, the sound of our voice, and so on. The second stage is sameness, and this is how children learn language around the age of two, where they want to be like us, so they mimic our language patterns. You know, they won't do a particular thing, but if you tell them that their favorite cousin always eats that cereal, then they'll eat the cereal.
Mm.
The third stage is belonging or loyalty, and it's the sense the child has that we're on their side, we're their ally. There's a very cute possessive quality to many three-year-olds where they'll push their siblings off your lap, or they'll tell you that they're going to marry you, or like that. The fourth stage is significance. It's the sense the child has that they're cherished as is. They're celebrated for who they are as is, not because of the grades that they got or their performance on the stage or the ball field. The fifth stage is just pure unadulterated love. Around the age of five, the child begins giving you their heart. There's just a sweet love that passes between you. And then the last stage, from the age of six on through their life, is being known. This is the child who tells you their secrets, who tells you what's really going on for them. It's a very intimate form of connection. All relationships, even the work I do with couples, you can follow this arc or this trajectory of connectedness as it goes deeper. And so when we look at attachment we certainly want to keep fueling attachment through those inroads, and I talk about that in that chapter of the book, different ways to continue throughout a child's life to build attachment in those six, using those six pathways. But as a child moves into adolescence, you know, going back to your question, the attachment doesn't diminish at all. We have to continue to fortify the attachment and fuel it. What does shift is that we move more toward an advisory role with them than a pure captain that just tells them what's going to happen. So with my 19-year-old, he might call me and start talking about what classes he's thinking of taking. And rather than telling him, I don't think you should take, you know, that particular, you know, the history of blues, you know, which I actually think he should take, I might say, well, tell me what you're thinking about that. What are the pros and the cons? I want him to begin to think for himself. Well, more than begin. I've always wanted him to think for himself. I want to challenge his thinking and ask him why he believes what he does. So there's a very gentle, you know, transition from childhood to tween to, you know, pre-adolescent and so forth into young adulthood, where we're always going to want a strong and deep attachment to the child, but our role in terms of advisor will shift.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Susan Stiffelman is our guest this afternoon. She's family counselor and parent. She's a licensed psychotherapist. She's the author of Parenting Without Power Struggles, Raising Joyful, Resilient Kids While Staying Cool, Calm, and Connected. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions or comments. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Outside the local dialing area, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, how are attachment and connection related to resiliency?
What forges a child's ability to become, in fact, let me just back up and say this. We're not raising children, actually, and I really believe this. We're not raising children. We're raising adults. And if we understand that, then we think about what makes for a resilient adult. It means that it's someone, among other things, that can handle life's ups and downs, disappointments, hardships, and come through as opposed to crumble and fall apart. Mother Nature, once again, is really, really smart. So she creates childhood to provide many, many opportunities, really, in the course of any given day, for a young child to be frustrated. Now, how we help the child handle that is what determines whether they're going to build that muscle of resilience and become better and better equipped to handle disappointment, or whether they're going to, you know, if we do what I call move the universe to where they would prefer it to be, then all we do in that scenario is avoid a child's unhappiness and aggression. And so my work is about really helping parents, first of all, accept that it is not their job to make sure their child is happy all day long. Even though we long for that, it's very painful as a loving parent to see your child unhappy or suffering. But we're literally depriving them of a really vital opportunity to strengthen their ability to discover, wow, I got through that and I survived and I lived and I was okay. There's only two outcomes to frustration. One is aggression, and one is adaptation. So to me, our role as the captain of the ship, as the parent in charge, is to help the child move through frustration to adaptation, as opposed to simply giving in because we're afraid of their aggression or enduring the aggressive behavior.
The most frequent calls for help you get are from parents with aggressive kids.
Yes.
How do you begin helping parents and children in that situation? How do you help them move through frustration?
You know, a child, always, you know, children are very present-based. They want what they want when they want it. And they're very passionate about their desires, especially if they really want something. Parents, you know, I start by helping parents understand that they're not serving their child when they give in. On the other hand, it doesn't mean you never give in. I'm a mushy parent in many respects. But it does mean that you start by understanding that, you know, parenting is not about just making sure your child is always happy. And I explain to them that frustration is going to either head toward adaptation or aggression. That's what they're going to get. So the way we move toward adaptation is we give the child who's upset a proper act one, maybe not in the moment if you're busy, but if you do this now and then, it's very interesting because many kids walk around with what I call a low-grade fever of frustration. They're always frustrated on some level, and it takes very little to set them off. And so this act one strategy that I've developed can be done now and again, and what you're doing is sort of draining the tank of the pent-up frustration that just shows up, you know, at random. So when you give a child an act one and you acknowledge, you know, what they're feeling, their frustration, without trying to fix it, you help them offload it. So let's say the child is frustrated, going back to the chocolate cake. Unless you'd like, would you prefer a different scenario, Celeste?
I was thinking, you know what, the first story that you tell in the book is about a struggle between mother and son about him getting up on time
okay.
to get
yeah.
ready for school. And that's a good one because I think the chocolate cake isn't a 911.
Yeah.
Getting
exactly.
up every day and getting the
yeah.
getting the work done, that's a 911 or a 711 or something.
Okay, sure. In fact, I'm really glad you brought that one up because it is, and I think that's in Chapter 1 where I'm really introducing a very important idea, and that is that one of the things that causes us to lose our foothold as the captain of the ship with the right hand at the top is actually not our child's problematic behavior or misbehavior. It's what I call, we're resistant to the fact that our child is behaving as they are. In other words, I tell parents we have like a snapshot child. So imagine in your right hand you're holding a little snapshot, and the snapshot child gets out of bed as soon as you wake him. And he cheerfully bounds down the stairs to have breakfast and says, thank you, after you serve it. And your snapshot child quickly gets his shoes on when you remind him and grabs his backpack and gets in the car. And your snapshot child even says, thanks, Mom, when you drop him off at the bus. So the problem isn't that our child does none of those things or doesn't do them all. It's that we think he should, and we're stuck comparing the snapshot child to the real child in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
And this might sound a little bit radical, but if you'll hang in there with me and your listeners, if you'll hang in there, it does make a lot of sense. What causes you to lose your footing as the calm, confident captain of the ship that can steer the child through frustration to adaptation is needing them to be different than they are, behave differently, needing them to put their shoes on, needing them to wake up. Whenever you need anything from a child, the right hand is below the left. So in that scenario, I had to start by getting this mother to look at what she was making it mean in her thinking when her child didn't get up right away. And there's a process that I introduced that I did not develop. It's been developed by a woman named Byron Katie, who's given me her blessings to talk about her work and use it in the book, that gets you to look at the thought that triggers your upset. Because if I could get you to walk into your son's room who's still sleeping for the fourth time you've woke and not be reactive, the way things would unfold would be very different. Can you understand that idea?
Mm-hmm.
When we're triggered and we're hysterical and dramatic, we fuel the drama. So helping a child deal with frustration starts by getting you not to be so reactive. And the precursor is to get you to look at the thought you're having. He should get out of bed the first time I wake him. That might be the thought. He should get out of bed the first time I wake him. And I would run through these questions that get you to look at it. And then I would say, well, give me a few reasons why the opposite of that makes sense in its own way. Why shouldn't he be getting up out of bed the first time you wake him? And if you were the parent, Celeste, what might you say, even though this is a little far-fetched, what are some reasons that he shouldn't pop right out of bed when you wake him, or the third time, for that matter?
Well, he might not be feeling well, or
okay.
he might have a test at school right. today, or it's gray and rainy and cold.
Yeah, and he's quite happy there under the snuggled under the covers. The more we can come alongside, as we talked about earlier, the more we come alongside the reality of our child, who they are, what they're experiencing, the less we're going to be coming at them. And so in that scenario that you're talking about, I helped a parent first sort of dissipate some of her own anger and, the story she was believing that he's disrespecting me, he doesn't appreciate me, all those things that made it much more volatile.
Mm-hmm.
And the more she could be more, I could see where he really wouldn't want to get up, she began approaching him differently. And she actually had a conversation with him, not in the morning, but in the evening, when they weren't in the frenzy of getting out the door, to more calmly and rationally listen to his point of view and say, I see that it's very hard for you in the morning to get up, sweetie. Why don't you tell me about it? And she was able to listen, and she gave him the sense that she appreciated the difficulty for him and, had him nodding his head, yeah, Mom sort of gets it. And from that place, she introduced a new strategy that had to do with what would happen in the morning henceforward. And so this issue of helping a child deal with frustration, that's not exactly, I'll give you a different scenario in a few minutes, but it starts with us not losing our cool when our child is not doing what we want or what they need to be doing.
Yeah. That's a tall order, though. Remain calm at all costs.
It is a tall order, but, I will tell you that the reason that the book is doing well is that it works. It actually works. And I think it's a little bit unique in the parenting world because I'm not just talking about what to say to your child when they don't get out of bed. You ultimately cannot change or control anyone but yourself. And so what I'm offering is a way to start with what you can change, which is your reactions. And as you start to change your reactions, and there are specific strategies for that, then the way you approach your child is different. Now, with a frustrated child, I would still have you kind of go through this process so that you're not as reactive, but sometimes you're not reactive. Your child's, didn't get invited to a birthday party, and they're very upset, and they want you to call the mom and make them get invited. And it doesn't mean you're all flustered about it, but you still want to be able to help your child move through frustration to adaptation. So in that case, I would offer the child this Act One and acknowledge what they're going through and not just mirror it like I see that you're hurt, but, tell me about it. I tell parents, the theme song of Act One is, what is it like to be you right now?
Mm-hmm.
What is that like for you? What was that like for you, sweetheart, when you found out that Daisy was having a birthday party and you didn't get an invitation? Oh, boy. Oh, my gosh. Really? And you're just not rushing to fix this situation. You're hanging in there with them as someone they can lean on as they move through their sadness and disappointment to adaptation.
Tell us about the exercise you call the three yeses.
Okay. When you come at a child and say, it's time to get your shoes on, okay? First of all, I don't like parents ending any kind of request with the word okay, because it sort of means you're not
you got an option.
Sure, yeah. There's a choice here. Would that be all right with you if you put your shoes on? I also don't want them to say, I need you to put your shoes on, as I mentioned earlier, because it positions you as being below or needy. So I would start by, gosh, sweetie, it looks like you're having a lot of fun here playing with your Cheerios. let's imagine that you're trying to get out the door and you need them to start getting ready. I imagine you're having a lot of fun there with those Cheerios, and the child would say yes. And I'm wondering if you'd sort of wish you could just sort of take your time this morning. Yes. Does it seem like it's a big rush to get out the door in time for school? Yes. You just ask questions that they would say yes to or nod their head simply because it lowers their defenses and it makes them more receptive. So by doing that, you'll typically find, and then you can say, well, sweetie, let's see how quickly you can get those shoes on, that they're just not as resistant.
Mm-hmm. You set them up for a fourth yes.
It's a little bit like the used car salesman. Gee, Mrs. Jones, I noticed that you have those 9 children there. I wonder if you ever wish you had a bigger car. Yes. And do you ever sometimes wish that you had window controls so your children couldn't open and shut and open and shut the windows at random?
Yes.
Yes, I do. And I wonder if you ever wish that you had comfortable seating that blah, blah, blah. Yes. Gee, may I show you the Honda Civic da-da-da-da-da van? Sure.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's really that same principle that when you're already nodding your head, you're more inclined to continue nodding it.
Yeah. Let's take a call. We've got a listener waiting for us on line 4 on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just listening, and I can't wait to pick up your book because it sounds like it was written for me especially. My husband's constantly telling me about changing my tone. But I have a specific question regarding my 16-year-old son. He is very easily distracted and is often, you know, forgets. I'll ask him to do something, and he'll walk out of the room and forget about it. And I personally feel like part of this distraction is due to things like wearing his iPod or, you know, checking out his Facebook or texting on his cell phone. And so my reaction has been, and I'm sure it's probably wrong, but my reaction has been when he, you know, continually forgets to do things and has to be asked 3 and 4 times, I want to take away these things from him, or at least one of them. And I've done that, you know, and obviously it's not working because the pattern keeps repeating itself.
Well, there's a few things that I would say. Thank you so much for your question and for calling. Has he always been forgetful and distracted, or just in the last year or two?
No, he's always been a little bit like that.
You know, I don't know if we want to drift in this direction. I'm actually giving a talk tonight at a high school on ADD-ishness. I call it ADD-ish because I don't believe that it's a proper diagnosis or label calling someone attention deficit. I don't think it's a deficit or a disorder, and I certainly wouldn't say, you know, that this is what's going on with your son. But I will tell you that I think we're breeding a generation of kids who have very short attention spans because of the onslaught of electronic stimulation and devices. And I don't honestly think that our brains are really, you know, have caught up with that bombardment of input. So there's that element, and I certainly would support you in managing how much screen time he has and how, you know, helping him. You know, I have this problem much of the time with teens. They just are, find it almost intolerable to have a regular conversation because it's just not as energizing and stimulating. But I also want to throw in there, if this is a child who has chronically shown this behavior, you know, well before devices...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I mean, would it not manifest itself academically if he were having...
It just depends on the child, and it depends, you know, some kids, and again, I would never even begin to talk about this as ADD. I think most kids, we're way over-diagnosing, but what the reason I mentioned it is that there's a whole spectrum. All of us are somewhere on that spectrum of attentive issue, you know, attention issues, impulsivity, forgetfulness, organization, and focus. And what we see is that there's in some population there's about a 30% developmental lag. So you could have a 16-year-old, but in terms of their ability to stay organized and remember their books and remember to do this and that, they might behave more like a 12-year-old. And so sometimes it's difficult to parent a teen who has some focusing or attention issues. Again, not necessarily ADD, but just, you know, we're all somewhere on that spectrum because they might look like a 6'2", 16-year-old. But
exactly.
In certain respects, the prefrontal cortex, which is what manages organization, memory, focus, many of those qualities are involved there, does not fully mature until the age of 25. And so sometimes we have expectations, and they're reasonable ones, but I would try a different strategy than just taking things away, especially if that's not really working.
Right, but I mean, but would you not agree, though, that if he is, you know, forgetting this, or maybe it's just selective hearing or whatever, but if he's, you know, blowing me off,
I would absolutely limit.
That having these other distractions
absolutely
make this condition worse.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. I think that they fuel the problem. My work is much more about avoiding or dealing with the root of a problem than simply managing the symptom. Yeah. And so I would look, you know, underneath that and understand what is fueling it. For some kids, for instance, as they move into adolescence, there is a loneliness. There's a sense of not feeling connected to others or feeling different, some depression. And so some teens manage that by numbing themselves with constant stimulation of a device of some sort. And so part of what we as the captains of the ship need to do for them is help them actually feel their sadness or whatever they're going through and walk them through it, as opposed to just sort of contributing to them not feeling and numbing out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I really appreciate that.
Thank you for your question.
I am seeing that, you know, because by the third or fourth time, I just, you know, start screaming at them and say, well,
right, yeah.
What do you think in that case?
Yeah, that's probably not.
I know that's not politically correct. But, you know, I just get so mad, and I do see that it really does just make everything worse. So I am earnestly and honestly going to look for your book and
read it. Oh, great.
So
well,
thank you very much for taking my question.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Our guest this afternoon is Susan Steffelman. She is the author of Parenting Without Power Struggles. My name is Celeste Quinn. We've got a few minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You have a lot of good questions in the book designed to help us begin a discussion, begin a conversation rather than, you know, I think sometimes we're all too ready with advice or explanations rather than listening. But one of the questions that you ask as a useful question that we can put to ourselves, what's the payoff for a particular misbehavior?
Right. Yes. You know, we all only do things for payoff. There has to be some reason. So, for instance, if I have a child who's being dragged along with the big brother to take them to soccer practice, and he's bored in the back seat, and he's playing with the window, or he's kicking the, you know, the seat in front of him, and the parent simply says, "Stop that, Johnny." I said, "Stop that," and it continues to escalate, and Johnny doesn't stop. I'll explain that eventually, you know, if mom pulls the car over and starts screaming and shouting and threatening and all those things, how many times have I told you that mom has effectively done what I call turning on mom TV? So the payoff in that scenario is, boy, things were pretty boring in the car until I started playing with the window and rolling, you know, and now it's interesting in here. And so if you simply try to get the child to stop doing something and not address the fact that, hey, as the captain of the ship, I need to be proactive and look at the under, you know, sort of the causal piece here. If I have a child being dragged around the car, maybe I need to provide him with some activities to do. Mm-hmm. If you're on a ship, going back to that analogy initially, and the captain hits an iceberg one day, you know, on your three-month cruise, you know, hopefully he's going to be calm and manage it and deal with it, and that's, you know, it'll pass and you'll be fine. If the captain hit an iceberg every single day, you'd be worried. And so when you have the same problem over and over again with a child and you're simply trying to manage it, my work is, what is the child getting out of this? What is this behavior announcing? Maybe it's not a payoff in the same way that the child was bored and now he's not. Maybe the behavior is, this is a child whose behavior is telling you that he's depressed and needs some help, or, you know, is struggling with alcohol, or you know, has very poor social skills and needs some help learning how to engage appropriately with other kids. So I'm much more interested, as I said, in looking underneath the problem and identifying the reason or the payoff than I am, you know, like Jeopardy. If whining is the question, if whining is the answer, what is the question? Exactly.
Yeah.
Instead of let's just get them to stop whining.
Yeah. You know, you said earlier something that I think is important, and I just want to go back to that. And what you said is, we're raising adults, but they're not yet adults.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we're asking kids or allowing them to be adults too quickly?
Yes, In certain respects, I think we are, and in other respects, I think we're coddling them far too much. You know, my son had chores every weekend for 2 hours when he was a teen, and he was one of the only kids in our town that he knew of that did. But he then called me from college about a month after getting there saying, you know, that he was very grateful for the way I had raised him. He really felt that he had learned responsibility, and it was an amazing phone call to get, you know, from a young adult.
Yeah.
But I think that in some respects we're turning them loose without them being ready. I mean, you know, right now we know what's in the news. People are talking about Sarah Palin and her daughter, and you know, who knows? You never know what's going on behind closed doors with a family. But I do believe that it's so difficult to walk that line between how involved should I be and how much do I turn responsibility over to them and trust that they're making good choices and decisions. So it's not a simple answer. I think in many ways that we need to stay more involved than we probably thought we had to. And in other respects, we need to give our kids more real responsibility than we probably do.
There, we'll leave it. We're out of time. Susan, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. It was really a great conversation.
Susan Stiffelman is a licensed psychotherapist, teacher, and parenting coach. She's also a mom. She's also the author of Parenting Without Power Struggles. The book is published by Morgan James, and you can find her online at www.passionateparenting.net.